Is anyone here for the first time for meditation? How many have not meditated at all before? Okay, so this is a meditation which has no technique. If you have been meditating and been doing a certain technique, then the request is not to do that technique here. Whether it is japa, whether it is concentration, whatever it may be. This is an allowing. Nothing has to be stopped. Even if thinking happens, it is to be allowed and it is to be witnessed. So no thought is judged as good or bad. Least interference in what arises in 30 minutes, but simply shining the light of witnessing. If a thought comes up of work, of someone saying something to me, let it be. If you get carried away for 10 minutes, and suddenly you become aware that I was thinking about something, so be it. It is all okay. And why is it okay? Because in this meditation, where there is no doership, no effort exercised by us, we will find by and by that the quality of witnessing starts permeating daily living. That is what happens. Disidentification from the stream of thinking brings about Sakshi Bhav, which is witness consciousness. It doesn't need you to do anything. Palms up, because that way we receive energy if you're not uncomfortable. If you're uncomfortable, then by all means you can put your palms down. This is not a rigorous discipline. Yes, the spine needs to be straight because the energy flows best in a straight spine. So that has to be kept in mind. And don't stop yourself from itching if something itches. Just go with the flow. Today is Easter Sunday, signifying a new birth. Jesus is supposed to have said, "Come unto me, and I will unburden you and give you rest." I don't think anyone else has said that, because it implies that you come unto me and I will wipe your slate clean, nullify your karmic account. Takes guts. And foolish as we are, very few people followed him. What an opportunity was missed. Come unto me and I will unburden you and give you rest. And in the Gospel of John, which stands apart from the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, because the Gospel of John emphasizes on the teachings of Jesus, not on the miracles, the I am teachings. And in that gospel, John says the last word mentioned by Jesus is tetelestai in Greek, tetelestai, which means it is finished. It is finished. The job has been done. And if that is what he said, it confirms the statement, come unto me and I will unburden you and give you rest. And so these teachings are not much different, because they are dissolving the thinking mind of the ego, the troublemaker that has been ruling our lives since we were very young, causing us to suffer psychologically. So when we are unburdened of the thinking mind, when we expose it, see all its antics, see what it thrives and survives on, what people did to me, what God did to me, and what I did to people. When this is exposed and seen that the hand of God is above everyone in my life, this poor me and this obsession with my story, my problems, my ups, my downs starts disintegrating. And when I find that my mind is less and less agitated, living less and less in the past which is gone, and less in the future which is imaginary, I am resting in the I am, pure presence, pure being, right here, right now, available to what comes before me. Why do we close our eyes in meditation? You can say so that we are less distracted by the outer world. But most of consciousness flows out through the eyes. So when we close our eyes, that much more is diverted within, just like in deep sleep. Can you have deep sleep with your eyes open? So what has happened in deep sleep is the consciousness is resting. It is not engaged by what it sees. It is not externalized. That is why you will find that people who are visually challenged and impaired, their other senses are working much more sharply. They develop gifts. And what happens when we start transcending the polarity of life, the duality of life, when we are no longer buffeted between pleasures and pains all the time, our consciousness is at rest, not agitated, because the eye of wisdom, the third eye, the single eye, is operating. The eye which cannot be seen. When I know that no matter how old I am, my life experience thus far has been, I don't know what the next moment will bring, pleasure or pain. Everybody's life experience. Then I find this compulsion to run away from pain is no longer there. Better, I turn around and face the pain. The compulsion to run after pleasures is no longer there because I have realized pleasures are fleeting. When this is realized, that is the turning point. That is when slowly, 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 I start getting established in witness consciousness, witnessing the flow of life. There was a Hollywood actor whom I admired in my young days, someone to look up to, called Marlon Brando. Marlon Brando had seen many of his movies, On the Waterfront, Viva Zapata, Godfather. But his last years were very tragic, and he was very sick. He had heart problems, lung problems, diabetes. He was very sick. But he said some things in his last days which really touched me when I read about them. He said that the world considered me a god and a clown in the same breath, whereas all I wanted to be was a human being. And then he said, all my life I have been searching for meaning. Now all I'm looking for is stillness. All I'm looking for now is stillness. And everyone is looking for the stillness. Most of us don't know it, because the fact is we were not born with the thinking mind. We were born as pure being, pure joy, the joy of being. When we find that stillness, which is where all wisdom teachings take us, then we discover the meaning of life. And it is believed. In his last days, he called his friend Quincy Jones and he said, Quincy, I have a question to ask. Do you think we have laughed more than we cried? As simple as that. Do you think we have laughed more than we cried? Would anyone like to ask something about the meditation or share their experience? Then you're welcome to now. Or any other question?
This question has been going on for some time, and I just wanted to ask you about conditioning. In a family, there are twins, and when they grow up, they are unlike each other. So, if it depends on conditioning, how is it that they are not like one another?
Because everyone has come with their own vasanas and sanskars and their own blueprint. The parents may be the same, but the way the parents treat each twin might be different. Just like we know when they are siblings, they all are not treated equally by the parents, though the parents feel they are. The eldest one is treated one way, the youngest one the other way, the middle one another way. So it is too vast and complex a law. And it is simply not possible that twins, just because they have been born as twins in the same house, will receive the same set of conditioning.
So even if they are not twins, they'll still be different from one another.
I remember meeting someone who told me he had a brother and their father was alcoholic. So one brother became alcoholic, the other one has not tasted alcohol all his life. So everyone comes with their destiny, their blueprint.
So it depends on the genes we are born with. Does it mean that?
Partly, genes, conditioning, nature, grace, these are words. But everyone comes into the world alone. Even if it's twins who come, they come together alone and they depart alone. As per the divine script, how many breaths are assigned to each person, each body, mind, organism, as per the divine law. Yes, there is something called collective conditioning. For example, Eckhart Tolle clarifies this in The Power of Now. Women, because of centuries of persecution, carry a collective pain body. So it's not individual in that sense, that pain is a collective pain which has to be processed. So in that sense, there are similarities between people. Now, for example, I know a family where the father was schizophrenic, and all the three children are schizophrenic in different degrees. That was the destiny. But the destiny was also not to be schizophrenic in the same degree. So we cannot understand this vast and complex law.
So it boils down to our past karmas, our past karmas.
If we believe in past lives, if we don't believe in them, we look at this life. We look at our memory from the time we were born, how our parents treated us, how our friends were with us, and we see by and by we came with a particular script. We didn't know how wealthy our parents were, lower middle class, upper class, which religion we were born into. This all became our conditioning, how our friends treated us, conditioning. And this conditioning made us think we are so and so. This is me. This is my worldview, my opinion. This is my decision, is it? If your decision is based on so many factors which were never in your control, is it your decision? Or could you just say simply that in life I need to make decisions, but those decisions have never really been mine. And the outcome has never been in my control. So I continue making decisions. I have to make decisions as the mechanism of functioning in daily living. But the ego, which was obsessed, my decision. And if things went haywire, guilt and shame. And if things went well, pride and arrogance. This is the story of the me. Mired in pride and arrogance, guilt and shame, hatred for the other, in opposition to the other, to defend itself, my view versus your view. So the ego started perpetuating itself. This is me, this separate entity is me, and lost sight of the fact that neither am I the doer of my actions, nor is the other, as per what Krishna says in the Gita. So it's lived its life in conflict, continues to live its life in conflict with people and with situations, and this conflict disturbs its peace. When this is seen, then the journey becomes one of rediscovering that peace, which was my essence, my nature, when none of this bothered me like it bothers me now. That is the journey within. As my teacher would say, karma does not mean my action. Karma means action, karma, pure action. But because it became my action, my doing, the ego raised its flag up very high and said, "This is me." And now that flag has to be pulled down because the flag of I am is the one and only. The same I am is operating through everyone, which is consciousness. I am conscious, you are conscious. The rest is irrelevant. It takes both of us to be conscious, to have a relationship. You cannot have a relationship with a dead body. So it means the person you love and the person who's troubled you the most are just merely instruments through whom the same consciousness functions. That is a big step because it actually exposes a very deep fact that while I think two individuals are exchanging words, it is consciousness speaking to consciousness and listening to consciousness. The fall from the Garden of Eden is this belief in two powers, when we started believing in good and evil. These people love me, they are good people. These people trouble me, they are bad people. So when I split into good and evil, good and bad, that is the fall from the Garden of Eden. But when I see that there is this one power, there is only one, there's only one all-powerful, all-knowing, all-merciful, whatever you call it, one power, which I have no problem accepting, because I tell myself there's no power stronger than God. But then let's talk about daily living. Is any individual more powerful than God? So that one power operates through everyone, the ones I like, the ones I dislike. Now, what does this mean? I still have to operate in daily living. I still have to deal with the people who have troubled me. But now I find I am no longer in the revenge mode. You did this to me, I will do this to you. That game starts dropping away. I have to protect my interests. I have to see where my sanity lies. But because I'm no longer obsessed with this individual doing things to me, I find that rather than react unconsciously, I respond. I find I take balanced decisions regarding the situation rather than regret things which I say randomly and in a reactionary way. So the whole flavor starts changing of the relationship because I'm no longer obsessed with the individual doing something to me. That is what brings about peace, equanimity, and calm in daily living. By and by, I am centered, I'm grounded, and I find I'm no longer troubled like I used to be by what people say and what they do. That is all. It is so simple. The wisdom teachings are simple. When Jesus says, love thy neighbor as thyself, he is not meaning that you have to go and hug the neighbor, no matter how good or bad they are, you have to love them in that sense. He is saying, accept everyone the way God created them, with all their flaws, like you have your own flaws, the way God created you. A total acceptance, and then do what you think and feel you should do. So simple. So what happens is you no longer tell people they should be other than how they are. That to me is a form of violence because you feel you know best. You feel you know better than God. So trying to tell people how they should behave, how they should be, it's ridiculous. How do you know? Because you are seeing it from your own filters. Maybe your filters are flawed. You don't think about that. That is why Goldsmith, whose entire teachings were based on the Gospel of John, said no matter who he would see, whether the beggar on the road, the alcoholic creating trouble, or anyone else, he would say this is God appearing as individual being. This is God appearing as individual being. No longer individuals, God appearing as individual being. That becomes the mantra of life. Otherwise, till my last breath, I would have split all the people who I've come across in life into two camps, the ones I love, the ones I don't. Wouldn't you agree that that is a big misperception of this appearance? Because if I stand before a mirror, I only see myself. If I stand before a mirror, I see myself. So the one source consciousness, there is no other, unicity, totality, has manifested as this appearance in duality. There is no other. This life as we know it, this world as we know it, is a reflection of that one source, which basically means everything is a reflection of that one source. Nothing is apart from it. When this is seen in daily living, game is up. Pain will still arise if I am faced with a painful situation. Words may hurt me. I'm a human being, I'm not a zombie. But that does not get extended into the story, the psychological story. That is the only difference. It doesn't mean there'll be no pain, it doesn't mean there'll be no hurt, but that he hurt me or she hurt me drops, and the dialogue changes to I felt hurt because I was destined to feel hurt. That person is merely an instrument through whom the hurt had to happen. And then I might surprise myself. And rather than training my guns on that person, I might think, for that person to say such words, such mean words, they must be suffering. They don't know it. What must have happened in their childhood for them to be so mean? So my thinking about the other changes. There's no longer any ill will towards the person who caused me harm. Pain, yes. Ill will, condemnation, hatred, malice, out of the window. There's no room for that anymore. And when that is out, what I'm left with is peace of mind. So simple. If we consider life a battle, you can be assured that there'll be enough battles to fight till the last breath. Life is not a battle to be won, it is to be lived in peace and harmony, equanimity and calm. As my teacher would say, the purpose of life is not something exalted, it is to let life flow. The purpose of life is to let life flow. Just like the river, if there are rocks in its path, it doesn't start pushing the rocks, it finds its way around it, just like that. Or as Maharaj would say, you're at a railway station in Bombay, people are coming out of the station. You're not going to bump into all of them, you're going to find your way through them. So simple. But we resist, and the cliche, what we resist persists till we stop resisting.
I wanted to share the experience of silent sitting, but now I guess 4 to 5 times I have been in this silent sitting. So the thoughts were there during the first time. Not many thoughts because I just have one person who pushes and releases my buttons, Mithul.
Only one person. He's there.
So means it's just a mundane thought, like that was there. But now, today, it was one or few thoughts were there. That also routine, like I have to go back, like that. But there was more silence and passed through 2, 3 times, and after the retreat as well, the silence has deepened, like it has evolved or it is getting more deeper and deeper. Like it's not the same every time, and it is different. And there is something which is aware about the silence also. Now that is that sense is like coming in. Oh, silence is there and 2, 3 thoughts are floating. It is not disturbing me, but I know something is there, but I'm not involved in that thought or something. But yeah, this is from past 2, 3 sittings, it has come.
That's beautiful.
That is there. And I just wanted to thank you for like collective silent sitting, what we do, and you give us a chance to be here and just have this opportunity for 30 minutes to be here. And last year you posted a video on Mukta Bai, on the song
Yes, open the door.
Open the Door. And I guess this Friday only the Mukta Bai Marathi movie got released. Yeah, and I saw it yesterday. I was
Where is
just
it on YouTube?
no, theater Mukta
Theater.
Bai, Gyaneshwari ji Mukta Bai. I went and saw that movie. I was aware that there was society was like not very good with them, all the four brothers and the parents as well. Means the movie had all the journey and it was so touching that they were tortured a lot. And then also the loving and kindness, the teachings which all the four brothers, sister, Mukta Tai and Gyaneshwar ji and Sopan Dev and Nivruti ji, like everyone, and even the Jesus teaching, Maharaj teachings. And we have you that you're giving us like all the teachings on not every Sunday, but whenever you're giving it is like I'm very grateful. And we are all grateful for this so that we know about them. Because I never knew. I knew Sant Gnaneshwar Maharaj ji, but never Mukta Bai. But when I had your video, I guess last September, and that movie came, so I said I want to go and see that movie. And like full of tears, overwhelming. And when the teaching, your teachings also is the same, like all the masters saying the same about loving, compassion, kindness, and they have lived these teachings, and you're also doing the same. So like very grateful to you.
Thank you. See, group meditation is of tremendous benefit because the group energy lifts everyone up. Mahesh Yogi, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was quite right. They did an experiment decades ago in some city in the US, I think it was in the US, where they proved that with a small group lifting the energy up of the city, the crime rate dropped. So with group meditation, what happens is that it becomes easier to together move up. It's like a catalyst. And those who are regular meditators help, not deliberately, the energy just helps the mind quieten. See, if you go into a madhouse, as we used to be told, you will go mad, right? If you go, okay, there are two concepts here which are important: suffering by association and the joy of suffering. I'll go into this briefly. Suffering by association means if you are in a household where there are three, four members and all are very aggressive, you are not. You may become aggressive. You'll be surprised. Small things, you know, someone will come at the wrong time while you're sleeping and ring the doorbell, and you'll find you become aggressive, whereas it's not your nature. You'll be surprised at the reaction because we absorb. If there are agitated minds together, it is quite likely that you who entered that zone calm become agitated. Words also don't need to be exchanged. It's a vibration. There's this story, I forget the details, of someone asking their guru about what is suffering by association. He said it will be revealed in a few days. And one disciple in the ashram misbehaved. And this guru was an angry guru. So he slapped the disciple. And this person who asked this question was very close friends with this boy who was slapped. So he also got slapped by the guru. And the guru said, "This is suffering by association because you are associated with him." And he just did it out of anger and knew they two were friends. So what this means is, why is satsang emphasized on the spiritual path? When you are in the company of truth, those who are seeking truth, those who are tired of the material world, tired of wearing masks like they do to parties and social events, this company of truth, the vibration of the company of truth, elevates the consciousness. That is what satsang is. That is why you read any scripture, any master from yesteryear, they say, seek the company of the wise, seek the company of the wise, seek the company of the wise. For this, by association of sat, being in a sangha of sat, the vibration changes. Just like in one of the Upanishads, it is written that there's a log on fire and you keep another log next to it, it will catch the fire. The fire symbolizes awakening. Just by being in company, today this is missed because today it's largely a YouTube and Instagram generation. So I'm very happy seeing everyone on YouTube, Instagram. But I would say, because my generation was luckily one where we could go physically to meet such people. I mean, it would have been a total loss if I just saw them on YouTube, if YouTube was there then. Just like, imagine if there was YouTube and Instagram when masters like Ramana Maharshi, Sri Aurobindo, and the mother Anandamayi Ma were there, and we would say, "Hey, you know, you check that YouTube out, check that YouTube out," and nobody bothers to go and see them. Can you imagine the loss? But being in the presence, being in the company, you see, because everything is not processed through the mind. The whole body is involved, the whole system is involved, the heart is involved. It's about vibrations. I distinctly remember the first time I met Eckhart Tolle, which I found to be quite uneventful at that time. Later on, I realized I had been introduced to silence. Later on, when I looked back at that 1, 1.5 hours I spent with him alone, then I realized that being in that room with him, something shifted within, which at that time was unrecognized. Someone had suggested that I speak on Eckhart's teachings and Advaita, which I am planning to do a series of 4 or 5 talks, bringing the two together. It's quite simple because 20 years ago I underlined what I liked in the book, so I don't have to do much homework. It's very simple. My brother-in-law, he's a lawyer. He was never into this kind of stuff. Now he asks, you know, send a book, and he says, "Whenever I receive your book, First, I see what you underlined because then I don't have to read the rest. I said, don't do that because you might underline different things. But yes, largely I know what to speak about because the work was done then. So it will be nice to share his teachings in relation to Advaita and.
Hi, Gautam. Gautam, I have two questions.
This your first time?
No, I came last time.
Okay.
My first question is, when you said that you have a script, right, and there's a destiny, like in the non-doership, so when people say, we create our destiny, we can change our destiny, that is something I, want to hear from you more about that. And second thing, when you just spoke about, joy of suffering.
Oh, I forgot to speak about the joy of suffering. Suffering by association, I covered. When we are addicted to our pain, and the reason we are addicted to our pain seems quite unlikely, right? Who would want to be addicted to their pain? When the reason we are addicted to our pain is it gives us a sense of identity. This is me. Then I am experiencing the joy of suffering because this suffering shows me who I am because of a misidentification. Someone in a relationship, for example, who is suffering a lot, continues the suffering, continues it because the light of awareness has not shone, because it gives them this identity. I am the victim, I am the poor me. It is not being done consciously. So when we say joy of suffering, we don't mean joy in that sense, in a perverse way. We mean in a covert way. And there are thousands upon thousands of people who are thus addicted to their suffering without knowing it. Some will go for therapy, others will not consider therapy. Some, if they have a teaching which they are following, will expose this to themselves. That is again the start of the journey for themselves. So that is what I mean by the joy of suffering. In fact, perhaps a therapist can definitely shed more light on this. And I am the master of my destiny is true. Does it sound like a contradiction? It depends. Who is saying I am the master of my destiny? You see, it's a very tricky thing. I know there's this whole law of attraction, and I've spoken about this many times, that all affirmations, which is what the law of attraction is based on, are actually coming from our scriptures. The Mahavakyas are affirmations. Consciousness is all there is a Mahavakya. So it depends who is following this teaching of I am the master of my destiny. What is the approach? Is it the ego? What is it? Exploration, contemplation is required. It's a very long topic, so I don't want to delve into it now, but it's a very important topic to understand, because what tends to happen is when I go with this, I can change my destiny approach, a lot of frustration and setting myself up for disaster in case I don't get what I want. Disheartened, disappointed, dejection, failure, because I feel I am the master of my destiny. So we have to segregate these two aspects.
And that I is the ego, right?
If that is the case, that is where we can get stuck. It's a fascinating subject. What an amazing journey the spiritual journey is truly. I think anyone drawn to the spiritual path in any way, any form of yoga, anything, it's a gift. Because otherwise, you're just stuck in this wheel. So there's no such thing as not making progress on the spiritual journey. It's not possible because you're already placed there. You may think you're not making progress. And therefore, my teacher kept it very simple. How do you define progress? By the degree of peace and equanimity you feel. So if you're on a spiritual journey where you feel stuck, this is your measure. This is what Ramana Maharshi said. The degree of peace that you feel. That's all. It's not about attaining levels of samadhi. And you tell your friends, which level have you reached? Level 4, I've reached level 6. It's not that. This is the end of levels. That is why the Aghoris practice in the cremation grounds, because they say you can't go lower than the cremation ground. And this makes us lighter, lighter beings. When we are not carrying this burden of the thinking mind, we are lighter beings. Light is synonymous with consciousness. We are light, lighter. The light shineth in the darkness.
So this meditation which we did is near about what I think what mother's practice of meditation is also. So nothing without your effort, just putting the aspiration and letting her work or the force or the consciousness work in this is what I felt. But of course, because I also done some other, not other, but the similar type of meditation only. Whereas you progress, you can find more peace and stillness about it. So, what I understood was that the meditation which we did just now is the same thing, which I've been learning or doing, letting go of my doership and letting her do the things. And
Yes,
when the
absolutely
peace
the same
comes or the
thing.
light comes or the love comes, it depends on her grace. But the most important thing I think the takeaway of today is that we are so much into the act of doership, trying to seek approval, control, or security, and saying, I am the master of the things. Is that is why we reject the sayings of like what Jesus said, that come unto me and you can rest.
Yeah, because we think we are in charge.
And
ये साला क्या बोल रहे
that's the most
That's what happened in his time. Disregard.
Because I was reading a similar statement where mother said that forget all your karmas, whatever vasana sanskaras you have, let my grace work on and you will have a clean state. But the thing is, we are so addicted, like our addiction to pain, like what you say, the joy of suffering. I would say, why do people see melodramas on television? Because it is a pain body, an addiction.
And the beauty is it's someone else's pain, so I'm very happy.
It's
Let me see others suffer. No, it's true.
That's why like Big Boss the most
Yes,
popular thing.
yes. And all this content on TV, you see crime thrillers, horror movies, whatever, is because it thrives on our pain, and our content of our consciousness gets filled with all that. It's alluring. And fear is the most alluring.
And the other thing which you said that why go to satsang or yeah. So I remember I used to listen a lot to you also or to Shraddhaluji also. But when I actually came in contact with you, or when I actually came and met you or met Shraddhaluji, the amount of receptivity which increases, that doesn't come from YouTube's video. The sitting in the presence of a teacher is something which is I feel very lucky about it.
No, I also feel very lucky I sat with whoever I sat physically. Really, I feel lucky I'm sitting with you all. Why do I feel lucky? Because it has given me an opportunity to share what I learned. You see, it is a two-way street. It is not that only you all are receiving and I am giving. It may appear that way, but it is truly a two-way street because I imbibed certain things, certain teachings, and it gives me great joy to be able to share it with people who are interested in listening. So I'm selfish, you see, in that sense. There's a book, if anyone, I keep mentioning it, called Your Soul's Plan, which is very interesting because he's a therapist who regresses his patients not to the prior birth, but to the pre-birth stage. And he has taken cases, extreme cases, alcoholism, terrorism, and all that. And the person who has been regressed, it's quite fascinating because it shows that we do come with a predetermined script, which we are part of. The alcoholic is told that this is the role he will play, and these caregivers will be around him in the coming birth, and who will play what role. And normally, the ones who push your buttons the most, you'll be surprised to hear this, in the pre-birth stage, because they are the ones who love you the most, they take the tougher roles so that both of you all can learn your lessons. So judge you not because you never know. You will never know. And that is why I say often, you have to live your life such that when you know your time is up, you look at everyone, think of everyone, those you loved, those who troubled you, and say thank you. Thank you because all of y'all taught me different aspects of life. How not to be, maybe. How to be. Everyone was here to teach me a lesson. Hopefully, the lesson has been learned. There was a singer, a Hindi singer, and she said something very beautiful. She won an award. And her last words after thanking everyone were, my Hindi is bad, so bear with me. Meri ek hi khwaish hai ki jin jin se maine sikha hai, main unki izzat rakhu. Which basically means, may I live the teachings, all that I have been taught, and by doing so, I respect them. No hatred to be carried forward for anyone. That should be today.
Many of us will remember this at that moment.
Don't worry about
it. Now.
It will happen naturally. It doesn't need your effort, otherwise, you wouldn't be there. That is why Maharaj said, was it Maharaj or was it Krishnamurti? I think it was Krishnamurti. It is the truth that liberates, not your effort to be there.